to All the Best. I'm Michael Bryden. And this is The Doors' song, The End. It was originally written by Jim Morrison about breaking up with his girlfriend. Love makes you feel like that, sure, but then eventually you get over it, you move on, you start again. And this song stopped being a sign for the end of a relationship. In fact, Jim Morrison said in an interview with Rolling Stone magazine, "Every time I hear that song, it means something else to me. It started out as a simple goodbye song, probably just to a girl, but I see how it could be goodbye to a kind of childhood I really don't know. It could be almost anything you want it to be." And he's right. Endings don't really... You know what? I've got all this other stuff written down about how I don't really believe in endings. That it's just change and it's not final and Jim Morrison lives on through his music. But I'm not going to say it because it's not true. Endings happen all the time. Life's full of endings. Something exists and then it ceases to exist. It's gone. A memory isn't a person living on in your mind. Jim Morrison's music is no more a piece of him than his toenail clippings. And that's what we're looking at today. Not Jim Morrison's toenail clippings. Endings.
This is the end. Beautiful friend. This is the end. My only friend. The end. Of our elaborate plans, the end of everything that stands, the end. No safety or surprise, the end. I'll never look into your eyes.
And we're going to start with the most final and feared ending of them all. The only ending that we're guaranteed from the moment we're born. And for kids, the idea of this ending can be pretty tough. Kids are only just getting used to being here, let alone where they're going to end up.
Existential crisis at the age of 7. I can't remember how exactly it started, but I think it unfolded sometime after my grandmother died, when I realised that you could be in the world one day and then the next day not be here. And around that time, I think I started to ask my parents the big questions about life. I'd always known that we were atheists. At school, I'd had to go to the so-called non-scripture classes while everyone else went to Bible class or Quran class or Baha'i. And I just used to resent the fact that we had to do working class while they would sing nice songs and learn nice stories. One day I asked my dad what happened after we die, and all he could say was nothing. When you die, you just die, and your body starts to dissolve or disintegrate, and your mind goes with it. I remember we were on a holiday in a holiday house on a beach, and I went and locked myself in the bathroom and I thought about his answer, and it sent me into a tailspin of existential panic. This idea of nothingness and being nowhere just seemed to open a great chasm beneath me. I remember that being the first time that I really experienced panic. I started feeling all hot and bothered and tense and couldn't think straight, even though I was only 7. My mum is a science teacher and she dealt with the question a little better. She told me that when we died, we broke down, turned into soil and became part of the ecosystem again. And she used to lie in bed with my sister and I at night and tell us stories. And at this time, the only story that I wanted to hear over and over and over was the story of how the universe came into being. So she would tell us about the Big Bang and the way that it started out as a mass of atoms denser and hotter than anything we could imagine, but smaller than a pin, and that one day it exploded and that everything that came out of it is what exists now as a universe. Time, matter, space, the Earth, the galaxy. And that it's all still expanding. I could almost feel the momentum from the lower bunk bed of our room. So I would imagine that I hadn't been born myself, with a big sister, two parents, a ballet teacher and a flap hat. but instead I'd been born the sun or a planet. I would imagine something like a brain lodged inside a sphere with eyes that was just floating in deep space. But somehow it was aware of its own existence and the way that it was condemned to float forever in this deep, silent, endless space-time. So this period lasted for maybe 2 or 3 years, and in that time, the first thing I did was start going along to Bible classes with my heavily Christian school friend. She lived across the road, and her father used to come around and deliver videos to my heathen parents about good Christian parenting, even as he would tell his own kids to address him as sir. But those Bible classes ended up just me sitting in a Bible circle, terrified about the moment when the prayer circle would arrive at me, and I would remain silent and keep my eyes closed. And then when I realised Christianity wasn't for me, I decided to get into witchery. I watched a lot of Charmed in that time and lots of sessions of the craft. So I started casting spells on every aspect of my life and made my own Book of Shadows, complete with a hand-carved clay cover. And I made a little coven with my friends, a little bit like the Spice Girls groups that we used to make at school, but with more candles and more creepy chanting. I didn't talk to my parents about it much at the time, but I told them about it years later and they don't seem to remember this period at all, so I must have managed to hold myself together between my episodes of existential panic.
That was Caitlin Doyle Marrick on what the end looked like at 7 years of age. You might see death as a very final ending, and that can be pretty scary, but Zasha Rosen wondered about what happens to love in the end. He wrote this next story where the end only seems to be pretty final, but maybe you can find a loophole, if you know who to ask.
If I could bring back that man you loved with words, I'd do that here. If I could curl his easy smile across the page, I'd do that here. If I could spread his eyes in pencil lines and not in photos, I'd do that here. But since I can't, and since they're gone, I do this here. I remember it too, Marla. Remember how much you loved Mike. When he came along, how quickly you needed him. His lazy smile, his cruel confidence, and his easy love for everything. When he died, something in you went. The world fell flat. But worst of all, you grew a hole and all the deepest feelings leaked out of you. I couldn't leave you that way. It's hard to say this. Listen, let me start with a story. We'll get there. The day you told me it was all too much, do you remember? You know I love you, right? He was never my sort of guy, but, you know, the thought of the world without you is too much for me. So I went to talk to Sally. You don't know her, but she's a tall woman, Sally. She knows things. She was in and out of the underground rave scene in the 90s, parties in the 80s. She was in the Mardi Gras when rabble-rousing was more important than glam, and she played drums at the Peña. She's been around, and she knows things. So I asked her. Oh, there's one in Roselle, she told me. Just off the top of my head, that is. I mean, you could fly to Greece or Italy, but do you speak Greek or Italian? I don't speak Greek or Italian. Electricity runs on death, you know. Dead plants get crushed into coal or oil and they stew for millennia underground and then we just burn them. There's a lot of death humming away in a power plant. It used to work better when the turbines were still running, but it's still there. It's just a bit quieter than when I knew about it. I packed my things. A small shoulder bag, some water and food. When it was dark, I went down to Roselle, waited for the guards, snuck over the fence, and stole into the old power station. It was quiet like the grave. City lights washed in the high windows. Little ankles of old machines were on the floors, some broken glass. There's a splodge of concrete near the back wall, with a tiny round trench of concrete cracked around it. My footsteps echoed as I crossed the floor. When I got to the splodge, I pulled out a bottle of motor oil and poured it around the little crack. Just a little, you know. So it seeped in. I don't know Greek, but I've read it in translation. I muttered a few things anyway, just in case, and waited. I ate a sandwich. Soon the shadows grew longer. They washed in from the wrong direction over me and over the hole in the floor. I stepped back from them like a barefoot at the beach. Then the little things started crawling up from the cracks. I was ready in my head. Everybody knows that everything has some kind of soul. I try not to think about it. Too far down that path lies fruitarianism. But I saw the souls of oil tins, cogs, widgets, and boiler valves begin to seep out. Then rats. Not grey exactly, but that same colour you see when it's dim, and all you can make out are shades of dark and darker blue. Then a dog and some pigeons. A sharp-eyed ibis started pecking at some rubbish in the corner. 2 10-year-old children pulled themselves out. They pushed themselves onto the concrete floor with their elbows. Their backs were broken and their legs were crushed. They looked up at me as they pulled themselves across the floor, but they seemed more interested in each other. Then things began to move. The floor stayed still, but I could feel it shaking in the air. The round concrete hole lifted, like a tin lid, until it stood straight up. Oil dripped from its edges like blood. There were stairs inside. I stepped in. Underground places always smell the same. First they're dank, then they're cool, then they get hot. The passageway I walked in was the ghost of a maintenance tunnel. Then it became the ghost of a cave. Then it became the ghost of a white tent. Then a convict cut. I thought about coal and oil and compost and dead things lying underground that steep and change. Soon, the ghost of a tram met me. I sat in one of its narrow compartments, careful to avoid the gaze of the conductor. I paid him 10 cents with 2 coins, but didn't take the ticket. The tram took me into a cave, across the barren ground, and into the land of the dead. The Lord of the Dead sat on a throne made of bones. There was a remote control on the arm of the throne. He looked at me carefully. Around him floated grey-blue ghosts. Ghosts of dogs, ghosts of televisions, of newspapers, of telephone boxes and old mobile phones. There were galahs and cockatoos. There were old women, boys, dark skin, light skin, beards and stray curl. All of them grey-blue, all of them sad, all of them lost, all of them dead. Uncle Jamie called out my name. Grandma looked at my hands and cried out. The dogs started to howl. The birds clattered and flew to pick me over for scraps. I put my hand on my shoulder bag to keep it closed. A whirlwind of screams and faces and death, it washed over me, and there was an attractive warm shiver down my back. I tried to focus on the thin skin across the cheeks of the Lord of the Dead. Then the Lord of the Dead, King of Bones, Rich One and Greeter of Souls, looked up at me. He lifted a finger and the whirlwind stopped. The birds flapped off my shoulders. He looked at me with cool, dead eyes.
"Hello,"
I said.
"I've come for Mike, from Greenacre."
"Who?"
said the Lord of the Dead, but Mike's soft face was already pressing its way out of the pack behind him.
"Mike. Mike came into your kingdom not 6 months ago. They found him on the railway tracks,"
said Mike, but the Lord of Death shushed him.
"Do you know how often people ask me to give them other people who are dead?"
said the Lord of the Dead.
"All the time. I've been trying to catch up with that fantasy series with all the dragons in it, and it's hard enough without the constant interruptions. The plot structures of this show are Byzantine. I have to concentrate. Some bastard who read the book is bound to show up here before too long with spoilers. Go away!"
I became suddenly aware that there was a huge LCD TV on the wall behind me.
"Wait!"
I said, but he held his fingers to his lips.
"People have offered me gold. I own all the gold. It lives here in the earth with me. They've offered me men and women. I'll own all of them eventually. What can you offer me for your mic? Only living things bother me, and they all come here."
I regarded the Lord of Death a moment. Everybody knows that the Lord of the Dead in Sydney is called Morris, and watches a perilous amount of cable TV. I took the wireless router out of my bag. It was a little blue plastic box with 2 dark antennae on top. It wasn't plugged in, but I pressed a little button on the back anyway, and the lights on the front glowed with some ghost power. The ghosts of old video cameras, old wireless routers, plastic Ethernet cables, vacuum tube TV monitors and TV station fittings began to coalesce and started floating towards it.
Morris, give me Mike from Greenacre, or I'll release all of these little electronic ghosts right here and now. If you're not careful, they'll flit into the world above where they make television. Lo-fi TV cameras will infect the digital broadcast chains, dial-up modems will clog up the newsroom's data feeds, and servers from 1993 will slow down the internet to a crawl. You try watching cable after that, Morris. No channels, no catch-up TV, no internet news. The world above will be swamped with outdated data switches and crippling processor speeds. The dead devices will outnumber the functioning ones 30-1. You hear me? The dead will outnumber the living.
The Lord of Death snorted. He snarled. That sounds like a lot of work. He looked at me. He looked at Mike. He looked at his TV.
Take him then. I'll see you in your turn, Carl. And when you return to me, we'll be talking about this again. Mark my words.
Then he looked away from us and started watching a teacher on TV. The ghost of Mike floated over to me. With every step, his flesh returned. He wrapped himself in flesh, in blood. The loose organs flowed in. From the silent hurricane behind the Lord of Death, my uncle stood behind Grandma. They watched me turn and walk away. Walking away was all I could do. All the way to the surface, in the tram, in the ghosts of old passageways, I never looked back. I brought him back to you, Marla. Mum. I'm not joking. He's waiting outside, and honestly, I think he needs a hug. I brought him back to you not because he was dead, but because you're alive. You needed him to live. So live with him. I know I had to let the others go. I left them there. But I guess you have to leave things be sometimes. Where would I stop? We live in a world that's slow and somnambulant enough. The dead would outnumber the living.
That piece was produced and written by Zasha Rosen. You're listening to Older Best. I'm Michael Bryden, and today we're talking about endings and what happens in the end. Frank Herbert was an American science fiction writer who died in 1986. He wrote the Dune series of novels. He famously said, "There's no real ending. It's just the place where you stop the story." But that place can be, well, frustrating. You know that feeling of finishing a really good story? You've been living in this other world for so long, and when you emerge, it feels strange to be amongst real things. Sometimes it feels like a loss. There are no more pages to turn, no more episodes to watch, and no more podcasts in your feed. Older Best's features executive producer Jess O'Callaghan gets this feeling a lot, and wondered what it was like to get to the end of writing a book. Surely, it'd be 100 times worse.
When I finished the 6th Harry Potter book, I went out into the garden and I cried and I cried. I was at my grandparents' house and my auntie Lucy was sent out to check I was okay, I guess. I just remember her trying to say things to console me, and anything she threw out there, I'd just sob. I think about this a lot, that devastated feeling you get at the end of a really good book. You've been so immersed in this world that to emerge kind of hurts. But then what must it be like at the end of a book for the person who's writing it? To live with these characters for months and years, and then to leave them, and to know there's nothing else they can ever give you. Are you devastated, like I was, crying in the garden? Or are you just relieved? A giant exhale at the end of a marathon.
That's the other thing about the writing, is that it's a deferred joy, constantly deferred joy. You don't usually have these great moments where you can just simply, like, really celebrate in it and enjoy it.
This is Alec.
Hi, my name's Alec Patrick. I write under the name A.S. Patrick. The night I finished Black Rock, White City, I went for a walk down to the beach. This was maybe 5 years after I started writing what I thought was a short story, and went down to the beach. I don't live too far away from Elwood Beach, and was walking along the boardwalk, walking past a restaurant, and all these people started just milling outside of the restaurant on the boardwalk. I didn't know what was happening. Kept on walking for about 15 minutes and was coming back home, passing these same people again, milling outside this restaurant. And then realised there was a fireworks show about to start. And not like the kind of generic sort of fireworks show you have on a New Year's Eve, But this was the kind of fireworks show that you just have as kind of a personal thing, which I'd never seen that before, you know. But it was off this concrete pier near this restaurant. So I sat down on a bench, and this fireworks show started. And it was an incredible fireworks show. And I just finished my novel. And it was like, I kind of had tears in my eyes, because it really felt as though this most momentous day of my life, finishing a novel after 5 years' worth of work, and really intensive, difficult work sometimes, you know, it was finished, and I was having this personal fireworks show right above my head. Later on, I realized that the reason why those people were milling outside that restaurant was because there was a lady in there. She turned 100 years old on that night. And so the fireworks show and all those people were part of her family, and they were celebrating 100 years of her life. And so I walked home from that fireworks show, and I felt, what an incredible coincidence. What an incredibly beautiful moment, you know. And but then, you know, as I said, you're thinking the day after, perhaps, you're thinking, well, what is this? It's just, you know, A4 pages, you know, with me and my printed sort of words, and you're thinking about how to make it, you know, live.
Nicole Hayes felt it too. My name's Nicole Hayes, and my debut novel is The Whole of My World, and it was published by Random House. Basically, it's a young adult novel, and it's about a teenage girl who lives in 1980s Melbourne, a fictional Melbourne, but very identifiable one. And she lives with her dad in the wake of a family tragedy, and their only way of communicating is a shared love for football.
She wrote her first novel when her kids were really young.
Just the second they went down, I would sprint to my desk and write a chapter or even just do a revision. I'd get a good couple of hours every afternoon that way, and as soon as I went to bed at night, I'd do a couple more hours then.
By the time she finished, they were older, noisier, and she'd escape to a cafe and write in the evenings after dinner. That's where she was when she finished the book.
I really do remember it quite well, because it's the first time, and I'd had multiple attempts at this manuscript, it was the first time I knew I'd done what I wanted to do. I had the ending written a long time ago, but the story didn't lead up to it in the way it needed to. And I remember finally, you know, sitting there in a cafe where surrounded by people who didn't know me, really noisy place, just kind of putting down my coffee and just going, yes, this is it. Finally, the lead up to this chapter, it all makes sense. This is where, so I knew where I needed to go. I just didn't know how to get there. And that realization finally that I'd clinched it was enormous. It was more satisfying almost than getting that contract.
What they were explaining, though, was joy. A pure fireworks kind of joy. And I knew from the way Alec and Nicole spoke about the writing process that couldn't be all there was in the end.
Like, I read this biography on Tolstoy by A.N. Wilson. Tolstoy, as huge a writer as he is, he didn't write a lot of novels. And after writing those novels, he said that Tolstoy fell into the deepest depression, because it was as though he'd excavated his soul. And there's that sort of sense with writing and finishing a novel as well. Because it's taking so many of your memories, so many of your hopes and anxieties, so much of your life, you've spent 5 years of it. And there's a sense of massive depletion. You do feel excavated. You feel as though you've got a huge hole in your soul.
Probably in those initial stages, there's some relief, because it's quite oppressive to live in somebody else's skin. Knowing that you're going to have to put them at risk, you know that they're going to have to make mistakes that you don't want them to make, all of these things that, and I feel it deeply, and, you know, it's not, there is a 14-year-old girl inside me all the time that I'm living with, you know, every day now, even still. So it is very real to me when I'm in that body, in that mind. So there's a sense of relief initially. But I miss her. She's lovely. I really feel very, very connected to Shelley. And she'll always, you know, I know you're not supposed to have favourites, but she'll always be my baby.
So there's that as well about finishing a novel. It's this sense of being emptied, you know, of so much that is really crucial to you, is really vital to you. You know, so it's a sense of like you're preserving something that's really crucial and vital to you. But there's almost that sort of sense of like you caught the butterfly and you've killed the butterfly so that you could put it into a glass frame. If you hadn't put it into the glass frame, it would just be a memory and it's gone. So the glass frame is important, because every time you look at that butterfly behind the glass frame, it's still there. You can see the proof of its existence, you know? And perhaps that's what novels are in the end. They're proof of existence. Not only of our own lives, but the things that we've cared for, the things that we've loved, the people that we've loved, the things that, you know, that were important to us. But we do kind of kill it in the process of preserving it. So there's that sort of sense of loss with finishing a novel as well.
That was Melbourne author A.S. Patrick talking to Jess O'Callaghan. And with that, this is the end of the In the End episode. But don't worry, because in the end isn't really the end of anything. It's just the end of this bit. And we'll be back next week with another show and another ending. This episode of All the Best was produced at Syn Radio in Melbourne in association with 3RRR in Melbourne, FBI Radio in Sydney, and 4ZZZ in Brisbane. Thanks to Caitlin Doyle Marrick and Zasha Rosen for producing the stories in this episode. Our features executive producers are Heidi Pett and Jess O'Callaghan. Our community coordinator is Pip Rasmussen. Our executive producer is Jordana Caputo, and I'm Michael Bryden. All the Best is played across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation.
I am not your end. Does that make me alone? Does that make me an old one? I am not a friend of me. I don't know what to do, what to do, what to see, what to choose, what to be, who to use, who to leave. I am not, I am not. But I keep myself alive. I keep myself upright. Waiting to go away. Waiting to just stop dying. Waiting to just stop dying. Yeah. Ooh. I ain't got a plan. Does that make me a vegan? Does that make me fool? I keep myself alive. I keep myself alive.